First, what I wanted to ask you was, what initially sparked your interest in the story? How did you get involved?
Well, the producers of the film, Frank Boring and Jim Smither, run the Veterans History Project at Grand Valley State University, and Jim Smither is my husband. And one day, we were sitting on our front porch, and he was complaining. Oh, we can't find it. Oh, the script. We don't know what we're going to do. We need a script. We can't find a screenwriter. This is terrible. They had one treatment they'd gotten that they just hated, because it wasn't at all what they wanted to do. And they had decided they had to do a movie because they've got all these wonderful interviews, and that's the best way to put this information out there. And I had listened to this conversation for a very long time. And I said, "Dear, would you like me to try it?" And we decided in the end, why not? What's the worst that could happen? I could come up with something that was useless, or I could come up with a movie, and I came up with a movie.
How much did you know about the story before jumping into it?
I knew about A League of Their Own because I'd seen it. I loved the film. I knew a little bit about it because when you teach women's history, you write about women in history, and this is one of the things I wrote about. But I didn't know the ins and outs. I had heard about Jim talk about the interviews because they went to reunions in 2009 and 2010, and he would come back just absolutely pumped because of these wonderful stories the women were telling. But I hadn't sat down and listened to the interviews and looked at the interviews, so I had to still do that. So I didn't know a lot. And while I go to Whitecaps games and I listen to baseball as it passes by me, I didn't really know that much about baseball either. So that was kind of fun to learn that.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to learning about this, there must have been a special interest, of course, for you as a women's history professor, I imagine.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is my entire career. What I've looked at women who've done something that society told them they shouldn't be doing, because I want to know why and how they managed to do it anyway. So my original work when I first started was women involved in partisan politics in the 19th century. Well, these women didn't want the vote. They just wanted to play. They wanted to be part of the political system. And I thought that was really interesting, that they weren't suffragists. They just wanted to be politicos. They wanted into that partisan system. Well, this is another group of women like that. They just want to play ball. They don't care that society's saying, oh, that's a man's game. You can't do it. You lose your femininity. You won't be a woman anymore. They love this game. And that was the thing that Dr. Smither and Mr. Boring wanted me to transmit in this movie more than anything else. They loved the game of baseball.
So take me through a little bit of the story of this, if you can, the abridged version that you probably tell people.
The abridged version is that in 1943, they were afraid, because of the war going on, that they wouldn't have Major League Baseball anymore. And Philip Wrigley, the Chicago Cubs, and Ken Sells, his associate, sat down and came up with a plan. They would get women to play ball. Now, women played professional softball, something I didn't know, and they played in leagues all over this country and in Canada. And Wrigley owned ballparks in California and Chicago where women played professional softball, and those games sometimes outdrew men's baseball. So he said, you know, maybe we can do this. Maybe we can have the women come play while the guys are off at war, and then when they're done, they'll go home like they're supposed to, and the guys will play again. And that's exactly what happened. The women played ball, and then the guys came back, and they started playing ball again, but the women didn't stop, because by then they had a league, and they had 14 cities they played from. They had over 1 million spectators in 1948, which was the height of their season. And they had farm clubs. They had players coming up from 13, 14-year-old girls coming up from those farm teams to play and fill the slots as the older players retired. It really was professional baseball.
Yeah, and I want to mention, too, I think, that while this was professional baseball, like, the documentary goes into the fact that there was a lot that was different from this as well. Ways to, I think, draw fans in different ways. Can you kind of go into that?
Well, for starters, Mr. Wrigley was very concerned that people come and watch these women play, but that they were still perceived as ladies. What he was very worried about is that the competitive nature of ball would be something that if women got into that whole competition, that somehow they wouldn't be feminine anymore. And so one of the things he did was he made them wear skirts. He made them play in dresses, which most softball teams played in shorts or they played in long pants, and they didn't usually slide. I mean, you could, but it didn't happen very often because of the nature of the game. But in baseball, you slid. And so these girls were wearing dresses when they slid, which was not good for their skin or their legs or their knees or any other part of their anatomy. That was one of the biggest things that he did to draw the fans in because, you know, you're going to see pretty girls in skirts playing ball. It attracted a lot of young men, and the women basically put up with it because they wanted to play ball so badly.
One of the most surprising things to me as well was Wrigley had, I don't know if it was called a code of conduct kind of thing too, that kind of specifically laid out what these women could do as well.
Yes, you had rules. You had chaperones and you had rules. All the girls were chaperoned. And that made sense because these are young women. A lot of them are literally teenagers. And you don't want them going off from city to city in the world without protecting them. So you had chaperones and they had bed checks and they had curfews and they had also rules about behavior. You couldn't wear pants. You couldn't wear shorts anywhere. If you were on the bus traveling from town to town and you were dressed in shorts because it was hot, you didn't have air-conditioned buses. Before you got off the bus, you had to put a skirt on. And if you were playing, you had to wear makeup. So you've got a catcher that's putting on lipstick and mascara and powder, and then a catcher's mask, and then going out into the hot sun and trying to play. To us today, the rules seem absolutely ludicrous. But Wrigley had a point. First of all, you drew in more people because these were young, attractive women, and you're keeping them attractive while they're playing. And the second thing is people really were worried about what women would be like in competition. I mean, one of the big changes that took place in women's sports way back in the 1910s and 1920s was that they were steered away from competitive sports because of the fear of what it would do to them. You know, it might affect their ability to bear children or something. It's just one of those weird ideas that Americans come up with for dealing with women. It's not a good idea, but it is a weird idea that they have.
Did this help to dispel that at all? Or I guess because they were still wearing skirts and makeup and things, it probably didn't do much. I don't know.
Well, it kind of depends. I mean, long term, I think it did. And if you ask the ladies, and all of them got asked this question of, you know, what do you think the effect of the league was? Most of them will say, well, it's kind of hard to say because there wasn't anybody after them right away. They ended in 54. There were a couple of all-star teams that played games all over the country at that point, made up of former players. But pretty much they ended in 54. And if you look at women's sports, there's not a lot of really big-time women's sports for a long time after that, until you get to Title IX. But I think that, like a lot of other things, they were maybe a stone in the pond, and the ripples spread a lot farther than they ever thought they would. And I think it did have an impact because people who knew about the league and wrote about the league and played in the games or went to the games and saw those remembered that. And maybe if they had a daughter who wanted to play softball or wanted to play baseball or a granddaughter, they might have encouraged it because they'd seen those women play when they were younger. So it's just kind of hard to tell. There's no direct link that you can trace easily. But I think that the fact that they got so much press coverage, you know, they were in Life magazine, they were in Time magazine, they were in Holiday magazine, that they were on the radio, that they were on, I'm not sure if they ever actually made it on television. You get clips and stuff, and I'm not sure. I think mostly those were in the movies, those News of the World things. I think people knew about it enough, and they could begin to see that a little bit as they move further down the century in terms of women's sports.
So what do you think that meant then when Title IX came around? Is there just sort of a correlation kind of, is there a direct correlation that you can say, or is it something more just there was that history there?
I think there was that history there. If you're going to find a way to explain why it is you want to do something under Title IX, why it is women need the money to play their sports too, which is really what a lot of Title IX is all about, one thing you do is you look at the history of women in sports. And that was what's so interesting about this particular topic, which I did not know, is women played baseball from the very beginning of baseball. They played it in the 19th century. They played it in the early part of the 20th century. There's a group of women baseball players called the New York Giantesses. I have their picture. It's wonderful. But they had semi-pro leagues, particularly on the East Coast. But also, you can find articles in the paper from the late 19th and early 20th centuries where they talk about the women's ball club coming to town. And so if you're going to say, look, we want money for women to play And legislators are going to say, oh, women don't care about sports. You say, yeah, they do. And look, here's an example, and here's another example, and another example. So it helps build your case that women have always been athletic, interested in sports, competitive, even if they're not supposed to be. They do it anyway. So in that sense, there is a correlation.
And there's a quote that really resonates me from the end of the documentary as well. There is one of the women, she talks about meeting the U.S. women's softball team at one point and kind of them all coming up to her and thanking her and really, really responding to that. And I think that probably makes a big difference, too.
It does. It makes a huge difference. One of the great things about Penny Marshall's movie, which was based on a documentary done by Kelly Kandel, who was a son of one of the women who played. One of the great things about Penny Marshall's movie is that she took that story and introduced the entire country to this, because nobody really knew, like they'd know after you have a movie. I mean, that mass appeal, that mass marketing of this story is what really the Players Association, All American Girls Professional Baseball League Players Association, was formed because of that, because all these women who'd played saw that movie. Oh my gosh, we did do something really cool. And they started having conventions and they started having reunions and they started talking to each other. It was a way to sort of salvage that experience and build something out of it for young women today.
I also wanted to jump in and talk with you a little bit about when you listened to these women's experiences, what were the things that really kind of surprised you?
I was surprised at how early they learned to play. A lot of these girls played when they were little kids. I was surprised at how organized some of the play was. I mean, most of them, it seemed to me, were learning, you know, they were playing on empty lots with their brothers because that's all they had to play with was the boys. And so they'd play with the boys. But there were organized leagues, particularly there's one interview with Mary Lou Caden out in Boston, and she talks about playing in Nagatin. Well, that's the Boston Garden. I mean, good grief. That's wonderful. I didn't know that. And that was what was so interesting, was how many places they found to play. And then moving from softball into baseball, gradually for a lot of them. But for somebody like Jean Fout, who's like the greatest pitcher ever, and as has been said of her, perhaps the Ted Williams of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, she learned to play baseball. She didn't learn to play softball. And it was hard for her when she first started because the ball was too big. Well, it got smaller and smaller. So by the end of this league, they were playing with a 9-inch regulation ball, which the girls love because they get their fingers around it. Stuff like that I didn't know, and that was absolutely fascinating to me because I'm not personally a sports person. I mean, you know, I play tennis once in a while a long time ago, and I walk and I exercise, but I don't really do sports. So I found it very interesting to listen to them talk about what was clearly a passion for them, especially the ones that went on in women's education afterward and went on in sports education, because they were so passionate about getting kids to move and getting kids involved in sports, particularly the young girls, but really all the kids. I mean, they were teachers, a lot of them, afterward.
Yeah, that this was such a unique opportunity for so many of them to create this. Yeah.
It really was. I can't imagine what it must have been like to be 15 or 16 years old and to be recruited by Philip Wrigley's managers to come and play ball, professional ball, that you got paid for. I mean, that was the best part for these girls. They were getting paid, and paid really good money in those days. I mean, they were making more than their fathers were making. That must have been mind-blowing. And of course, in those days, you didn't have lots of the programs we have today to give scholarships for young women, and you didn't have sports scholarships for young women. So if you're going to go to college, how are you going to pay for it? And a lot of these women, they made enough money in their playing careers to save it up and go to college when they were done.
Yeah, that was the amazing thing to me, is that by the end of the story, you think, oh, these are going to be women who they'll have had this memory, and then that'll have, you know, that was a one-time moment in their life, and that was it. But it's something that lived on for them for years in terms of what it enabled them to do.
It had a huge impact on them. It turned them into, in some ways, I mean, a lot of these were small-time girls, or they might be, you know, from Chicago or someplace, but they'd never really been anywhere or done anything. Now they're traveling. They're meeting girls from all over the country. They're playing internationally because they went to both South America and Cuba. We talk about Cuba in the movie. They also went to South America to play. They've had all these wonderful experiences, and they take that with them. I mean, one of the women talks about how, you know, when when you were done, you had a like 6 or 7 occupations you could choose. You could be a worker in a factory, you could be a teacher, a secretary, a nurse. I didn't want to do any of those things. What we left out was what she did. She wanted to fly, so she became a stewardess. Well, that's an example of it. You get to see a life beyond what you knew when you first started out. And that was what was so remarkable about this woman. They took advantage of that. They had the drive, they had the ambition, they had the competitive nature to take advantage of what they'd been given. I mean, some of them did go back and become housewives and moms and whatever, but an awful lot of them went out and did something pretty unusual for women of the time.
I also want and curious, but we talked so much about the actual women who were in these leagues, but how did America react to this league?
Well, it kind of depended on who you were. Some people were a little put off by it. But because Wrigley had worked so hard at maintaining their femininity, people grew to accept them very quickly. There was very positive publicity. They also played a really good game of ball. I mean, that was what was key. It wasn't enough to be attractive. I mean, a bunch of girls in skirts playing ball, okay, that's a novelty. But when you play well, then you've got something really to look at, especially for baseball fans. It would never be enough for them, because they care about the game, to just have, you know, pretty girls in skirts. But because they played, and they played hard, and they played to win, and they weren't interested in just, you know, showing off, they were interested in winning the games, that made a big difference in accepting them.
We've talked a lot about kind of what these women meant to, you know, Title IX, these sorts of things, but they could. Were they... Thinking back, were they the first real women's professional league of anything that was a real major sport?
Yep.
What do you think that means, too? Do you think that really set a precedent for things, or at least set an example?
I think it does. It's just like anything else in history. Somebody's got to break the ground. And while you did have these semi-professional teams that did travel from town to town and did play ball, this was the first time it was all women. There were no men on their teams. They were managed professionally. They had professional coaches. They got paid. That's absolutely critical. They played great ball. They gave a great show to people who came to their games. And it lasted a long time. You've got a 12-year run where you've got the ability to go down and see women play ball. And I think that has to have some sort of long-term impact on sports in America and how it views women athletes.
Looking back now, how far do you think we've come in terms of women in sports?
Well, we have UConn blowing everybody out of the water regularly, and some guy saying, well, that's just, I'm not going to watch it anymore because they're ruining the game of basketball because they win all the time. It's like, I don't know that people say that about men's sports. And I said that to my husband this morning. He said, well, think about it, though. There have been Super Bowls where people, why, this is boring. Come on, these games are no fun. It's just a blowout. So I guess they do say men's sports as well. It just doesn't have the same impact. I think that women in sports still have to fight against this idea that there's something kind of odd about them. It's much, 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 much less than it was. Women take pride in their ability now. They have a lot of reinforcement around them. They see the value of sport. You look at commercials on TV, women are sports figures. But they still get paid less than men, don't they? Because didn't somebody just sue the other day? What was it, soccer? Or?
Yeah, U.S. women's soccer
team. U.S. women's soccer team gets paid less than men. Now, why is that? It's not fair. So you still fight those battles, and those, I think, we'll probably fight for a good long time. But, you know, the days of Billie Jean King having to beat Bobby Riggs to be taken seriously as a tennis player, those are long gone, which is a good thing. And I think the more women that get involved in sports, the better off we are as a country, frankly, because it's good for us to have women in sports, and it's good for us to see women doing stuff that they want to do because they care about it and not worry about what some clown thinks that they should or shouldn't be doing as a woman.